content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of The Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we are reading this week from the November 20th, 2015 issue of The Week magazine, the main stories and how they were covered. GOP candidates stake out distinct ground. What happened? The leading Republican presidential candidates focused on policy rather than personality in the fourth GOP debate this week, staking out distinct positions on immigration, military spending, and foreign policy. In a substantive two-hour clash in Milwaukee, the party's more experienced candidates sought to regain ground from the political outsiders leading the polls. Ohio Governor John Kasich derided frontrunner Donald Trump's plan to deport 11 million illegal immigrants. "We all know you can't pick them up and ship them across the border," Kasich said. Former Florida Governor Jeb Bush warned that Trump's proposals were alienating Hispanics from the GOP. "They're doing high fives in the Clinton campaign right now." But Senator Ted Cruz aligned himself with Trump, saying, "We should enforce the law." Asked whether inconsistencies in his life story were hurting his campaign, Carson said that he was an honest person being held to an unfair standard by the media. "I have no problem with being vetted," he said. "What I do have a problem with is being lied about." The candidates also battled over their respective tax plans and foreign policy. Senator Rand Paul questioned how Senator Marco Rubio could call his plan, tax plan, conservative when it added $1 trillion in military spending. And Rubio fired back by calling Paul a committed isolationist, asking, "We cannot have an economy if we cannot defend it." All the candidates agreed on the need for smaller government. "We must take our government back," Carly Fiorina exclaimed, earning one of the loudest cheers of the night. What the editorial said. The fourth GOP debate wasn't the most entertaining, but it was by far the most educational, said the Wall Street Journal. Bush had his best debate so far, demonstrating a solid grasp of both domestic and foreign issues, while Rubio, Cruz, and Kasich outlined detailed economic policies. Trump, in contrast, could offer only his usual vague bluster. When the former Apprentice star railed against the recently signed Trans-Pacific trade deal because it failed to address Chinese currency manipulation, it took Rand Paul to point out that China isn't part of the deal. "It was another strong night for Marco Rubio," said the Colorado Springs Gazette. His takedown of Paul on defense spending was one of the night's few memorable moments, while his emphasis on bolstering families and children should resonate with social and fiscal conservatives. All the candidates came off reasonably well, so the debate probably won't move the needle much. What the columnist said. "Ignore who won and lost," said Jamel Bowie in Slate.com. "All we learned was how out of step Republicans are with the actual economic needs of ordinary Americans." The candidates talked about providing relief for workers and families, and then opposed the $15 minimum wage, attacked Wall Street regulation, and offered tax plans that would require savage cuts in safety net programs. Moreover, they couldn't explain why recent Democratic presidents, including Presidents Clinton and Obama, have added so many more jobs than Republican ones have. That question will haunt the GOP next November. GOP voters can't say they don't have clear choices, said Jonathan Tobin in CommentaryMagazine.com. Under the Fox Business Channel moderator's excellent questioning, most of the candidates staked out thoughtful, well-considered positions on tax cuts, economic policy, and dealing with Russia and Syria. If substance continues to prevail, that will likely hurt Trump and Carson, who seemed at sea whenever they were required to do more than speak in generalities. That, in turn, would leave the path clear for the field's two rising stars, Rubio and Cruz. The debate offered a sneak preview of how Cruz plans to attack his likely establishment rival, said Ross Douthat in NYTimes.com. He took a hard line on immigration, an issue on which Rubio is highly vulnerable because of his 2013 attempt at bipartisan reform. Cruz also railed against sugar subsidies, a form of corporate welfare Rubio has backed. And he stressed that his economic plan adds up. It doesn't, really, but compared to Rubio's, it does. Cruz's positioning on all these issues is impressively calibrated for the battle ahead. This campaign is about to get very interesting. Controversy of the week. Ben Carson. Is the vetting of his life story unfair? Let's be frank about it. Ben Carson is a bit nuts, said Richard Cohen in the Washington Post. The presidential candidate topping Republican polls may have been a gifted neurosurgeon, but he holds a lot of kooky beliefs about evolution and the Egyptian pyramids. And now a host of self-glorifying anecdotes he's told about his life have evaporated upon examination. Carson claimed he'd been an angry, violent teen until he was saved by religion. But when CNN interviewed 9 of his childhood friends, no one remembered him that way or could corroborate his story that he tried to stab a friend. Carson also claimed he sheltered white students inside a locked biology lab during a riot at his high school, but reporters could find no one who remembered that either. In his autobiography, Carson said he'd turned down a full scholarship to West Point, but it turns out he never applied and was never offered admission. The list of distortions and lies keeps mounting almost daily, said Kevin Drum in MotherJones.com. One of the most glaring was Carson's adamant insistence in a previous GOP debate that I didn't have any involvement with Manatech, a shady supplements company. Yet Carson made 4 paid speeches to that company's sales staff, publicly claimed that the supplements helped him beat prostate cancer, and made several videos that Manatech used to promote the product. Obviously, Carson has a serious personal honesty problem. This is another high-tech lynching of a black conservative by the liberal media, said David French in NationalReview.com, and an inept one at that. Carson didn't fabricate a West Point offer, as Politico.com hysterically charged. As a top ROTC student in his high school, Carson was told he'd gain admission to West Point if he applied, and the fact that a handful of people couldn't remember details of stories Carson told about events from 50 years ago proves nothing. Sorry, media. Carson may be imperfect, but attempts by biased journalists to smear this good and decent man will only make him stronger. The double standard here is sickening, said Thomas Sowell in RealClearPolitics.com. The same media now feverishly fact-checking Carson's childhood memories showed no such zeal for investigating Barack Obama's ties to leftist radicals back in 2008. Or, as Carson pointed out to thunderous applause in this week's GOP debate, Hillary Clinton's litany of lies about her email scandal or Benghazi. The difference, of course, is that the media want a Democrat in the White House, whereas the rise of a black conservative like Carson represents a mortal threat to the left's vision and the Democrats' voting base. The notion that Barack Obama wasn't vetted in 2008 is absurd, said Eugene Robinson in the Washington Post. The media reported his associations with Reverend Jeremiah Wright, Bill Ayers, and the rest ad nauseum, just as they're doing with Clinton and Benghazi today. As a sitting president, Obama even had to produce his birth certificate to quiet Republican insistence that he was born in Kenya and ineligible to serve. Carson should quit the woe-is-me whining and accept the reality that running for president invites intense scrutiny. Let's not forget that Carson is running without any experience or record in public office for voters to assess, said Jack Schaefer in Politico.com. So practically everything we know about his hypothetical performance as president is contained in his biography. Given the power and responsibility he's asking that we place in his hands, we have every right to hold him accountable for his personal story. It was a good week for lofty ambitions. After NASA announced it would soon begin accepting applications from pilots, scientists, engineers, and other qualified candidates for the next generation of astronauts. It was a good week for the war on Christmas, which got off to an early start this year when Christian blogger Joshua Feuerstein claimed that Starbucks' new holiday-themed cups, which are bright red but lack the reindeer stars and other Christmas symbolism of the past years, are proof that the company hates Jesus and has joined the larger war against Christianity. And it was a good week for Recycling the King. After If I Can Dream, an album of 14 classic Elvis Presley songs with new orchestral backing by the Royal Philharmonic Orchestra, reached number one on the British charts. But it was a bad week for using your head. After the U.S. Soccer Federation announced that youth players in their development leagues will no longer be permitted to head the ball because of concerns that years of cumulative impacts lead to brain damage. And it was a bad week for sharing. After a study from Denmark's Happiness Research Institute found that people who gave up Facebook for just 1 week reported suffering less envy and being more satisfied with their lives than those who continued to use the social media site. It was a bad week for practicing what you preach. After a Florida police officer who was being honored at a Mothers Against Drunk Driving convention for making 100 DUI arrests showed up staggeringly drunk at the award ceremony. He was ordered to skip the ceremony and was suspended. On the briefing page, the struggle over the Temple Mount. Rumors that Israel will take over Temple Mount have infuriated Palestinians, fueling a new wave of violence. Why is the site so important? The Temple Mount is holy to both Muslims and Jews, and to Christians as well. A rectangular platform covering 35 acres of Jerusalem, it is revered by Jews as the place where God gathered together the dust to create Adam and where Abraham almost sacrificed his son Isaac. In about 1000 BC, King Solomon built the first temple there. That structure was destroyed by the Babylonians, and the second temple was built in 516 BC and destroyed by the Romans in 70 AD. The inner sanctuary of the temple, which housed the Ark of the Covenant, was called the Holy of Holies, a place where only the high priest was allowed to set foot. Since nobody knows exactly where the sanctuary stood, religious Jews are forbidden even today from entering the entire compound. They pray instead at the Western Wall, a remnant of the Second Temple's outer courtyard. Why is it holy to Muslims? Called the Noble Sanctuary by Muslims, the site is the third holiest place in Islam, after Mecca and Medina. The Quran says that the Prophet Muhammad took a miraculous night journey to Jerusalem on a winged horse in 621. There he ascended to heaven and spoke with Allah, before returning to Mecca the same night. It was on this journey that Muhammad received from Allah many of the main tenets of Islam, such as the requirement to pray five times a day. After the Muslim conquest of Jerusalem in 637, the Umayyad caliphs built the Al-Aqsa Mosque and the beautiful Dome of the Rock. The gold dome structure that is Jerusalem's most recognizable monument on the site. The dome is said to be on the site where Muhammad rose to heaven, while the mosque is where he first arrived in Jerusalem. Who governs the Temple Mount? Muslims have controlled access to the site since 1187, when Arabs took back Jerusalem from the Crusaders. An Islamic trust, or waqf, administered the site, and Jews were not allowed to enter. After the Six-Day War in 1967, the Temple Mount area became part of the occupied Israeli territory. The defense minister at the time, Moshe Dayan, met with Muslim leaders and reached a new agreement. The waqf would continue to administer the Noble Sanctuary, but Jews would be allowed to enter the site as tourists, but could not pray there. Has that arrangement worked? It has been the source of great friction, with zealots on both sides objecting to the status quo. Far-right ultra-Zionist groups associated with the late Rabbi Meir Kahan have for decades demanded that Jews be allowed to pray on the Temple Mount, something forbidden in the Talmud as well as by Israeli Supreme Court. In 1982, Alan Goodman, an American Jewish radical and an Israeli soldier, burst into the Dome of the Rock and started spraying machine gun fire, killing two people. He served 15 years in prison. After that, tensions remained high and Muslims periodically threw rocks at Jews praying at the Western Wall. In 2000, the late Prime Minister Ariel Sharon, then leader of the opposition, and Reuven Rivlin, who is now Israel's president, made a very public visit to the Temple Mount, surrounded by hundreds of Israeli police, to demonstrate Israelis' right to go there. Palestinians rioted across Jerusalem, and the Second Intifada erupted. How did the current violence start? Late last year, one of the radical rabbis who advocated Jewish control of the Temple Mount was shot in an assassination attempt by a Palestinian, who was later killed by Israeli forces. Violent clashes followed, and Israeli security briefly closed off access to the site. Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas called the closure a declaration of war. Ever since, rumors have spread among Palestinians and the Palestinian media that Israel is planning to take over administration of the entire complex. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's government has consistently denied that, and the Israeli Supreme Court has repeatedly ruled that Jews may not pray there. But belief in an Israeli takeover has incited a recent spate of knife attacks on Jews. Palestinians say that increases in the Jewish population in Arab neighborhoods of East Jerusalem and new archaeological digs in the Temple Mount area all seem to send the message that we are here to stay, we are here to rule, this belongs to us, says Hussein Ibish of the American Task Force on Palestine. How has Israel responded? It is trying to crack down on the zealots on both sides. Last week, Israeli police banned prominent right-wing activist Dov Morel, not just from the Temple Mount, but also from the entire city of Jerusalem for 6 months. Israeli security also shut down a Palestinian radio station that it said was encouraging attacks on Jews, and it set up checkpoints in Palestinian neighborhoods of East Jerusalem. But Abbas has continued to assert that the Netanyahu government is in league with far-right groups and is trying to change the status of the Temple Mount. As long as this deceitful propaganda continues, said Israeli writer Akiva Eldar, it is the average person, Israeli and Palestinian alike, who will end up suffering the most. Denying the temples existed. The Waqf forbids archaeological digs on the Temple Mount, Noble Sanctuary, because it is holy ground and an active site of worship. But in 1996, the Waqf made an alteration to the sanctuary, converting the Templar-era structure known as Solomon's Stables into a mosque. Hundreds of tons of soil and rocks were trucked out during the construction, and Israeli historians were outraged. Israeli authorities later found many Jewish temple relics in the dirt trucked from the site, including coins with Hebrew writing that refer to the temple. The Waqf was widely accused of attempting to hide evidence of the existence of the Jewish temples, which many Palestinian leaders say never existed. That debate continues to rage. The Aqsa Mosque was an Islamic mosque since the world was created, says Sheikh Muhammad Ahmad Hussein, the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem, just last month. It was never anything other than a mosque. Moving on to the columns now. The first comes from the U.S. Why marriage is crucial to conservatism. The future of conservatism is tied up with the future of marriage, said Ramesh Panuru, when National Review helped midwife the birth of modern conservatism 50 years ago. We focused primarily on libertarian economics, because conservatives' moral values were deeply entrenched in society. Not so today. The decline of the family is what most needs resisting in our time. Abundant evidence shows that children generally do better academically, economically, and behaviorally when they are raised by parents who are married to each other. Adults who are unmarried or raise children without a partner, meanwhile, are more likely to struggle personally and economically and need the support of the state to survive. People who depend on the state are not likely to see the merit of conservative ideas or to vote Republican. To promote a healthy and free society, conservatives should now focus on helping families flourish. If we put our minds to it, we can devise policies that will encourage people to raise their children in healthy marriages. Families provide the foundation people need to be successful in a challenging and chaotic world, and we need them to be strong. This from Spain. Catalonia seeks independence. Catalonia has exploded in democratic revolution, said Vicent Partal in Vilevab.cat. In its first session since the September regional election, the new Catalan parliament has declared, with a vote of 72-63, the start of a process toward the creation of an independent Catalan state in the form of a republic, and a process of democratic disconnection not subject to the decisions by the institutions of the Spanish state. Up until now, Spain has had the tacit consent of the Catalans to govern them, but now it has lost that consent. We are casting off the oppressor's yoke. Unilateral secession is a grave tactical mistake for the Catalan independence movement, said La Vanguardia in an editorial. It's flatly unconstitutional and will not be recognized anywhere in the EU, least of all Madrid. Even some of those who voted for this hyperbolic and poorly written motion seem unenthusiastic. There was very little cheering or even smiling in the parliament floor. Maybe the lawmakers realized they had upended the entire premise of the independence movement, which has always been based on gradualism and tranquility. An abrupt rupture is not what we voted for. The pro-secessionist parties won a majority of seats in September's election with only 48% of the vote. For them to yank Catalonia out of Spain is not intelligent, it's not fair, it's not necessary. The attempt will only end up hardening Madrid against the Catalan cause. In fact, Madrid will take immediate action to prevent the de facto breakup of Spain, said El País. This illegal act requires the use of all tools at the state's disposal, legal, political, and institutional, to defend democracy and the law. The one bright spot is that after years of coddling the separationist, Prime Minister Mariano Rajoy has finally found his spine. Catalonia is not going anywhere, he said unequivocally this week. Nothing is going to break. If he expects to keep his word, said ABC, Rajoy must unleash urgent police measures to show the secessionists the gravity of what they have done. Separatist leader Artur Mas and his cohorts have committed treason and should be arrested and tried like any common criminal. Catalonia's perfidy is the most severe attack on Spain since the coup attempt in 1981. It cannot go unpunished. These next few weeks will determine whether Catalan independence succeeds or fails, said Barcelona's El Punt Envi. The secession resolution gives the Catalan government just 30 days to start working on a new constitution and begin creating a separate tax office and social security administration. We must start right away. Those who hesitate will be left out of the process. History doesn't wait for doubters. And finally, from Japan, subordinate to the U.S. military. It's not just Okinawa. All of Japan is still under the thumb of the U.S. military, said Toshihiro Yamanaka. Officials on Okinawa have been tussling with Tokyo over where to relocate U.S. military bases, and many Japanese see the sovereignty issue as limited to the island. In fact, the mainland shares the same humiliation in times of crisis due to the U.S. military presence. The U.S. assumes jurisdiction when any accident occurs anywhere near its bases, and young U.S. Marines, just 19 or 20 years old, end up giving orders in an arrogant manner to seasoned Japanese professionals. When a fire broke out at a U.S. Army depot in Kanagawa Prefecture, for example, 51 firefighters from the city of Sagamihara were on the scene first. Yet they were not allowed to battle the blaze until the U.S. military arrived with 8 firefighters to boss the Japanese around. If one of the Americans' unreliable Osprey helicopters were to crash in the middle of Tokyo, unleashing mayhem and mass casualties, U.S. troops could bar Tokyo police and fire officials from responding to the scene. Mainland Japan is being treated like a dependency or a subject province of the United States. How long will our leaders continue to stand for this? And now our in-depth article, The Last Word. A modern-day Edison. The most prolific inventor in U.S. history got F's in school, said Ashley Vance, and helped bring down the USSR. It's really a one-person sort of vehicle, says Lowell Wood, right after he offers me a lift. His brown 1996 Toyota 4Runner, parked outside his office building in Bellevue, Washington, has 300,000-plus miles on the odometer and looks it. Garbage bags take up most of the back. He squeezes his paunchy 6-foot-2-inch frame behind the wheel and, using his cane, whacks away papers, more bags, and an 80s vintage car phone to clear some room on the passenger side. The interior smells like pet kibble. Wood puts the keys in the ignition and then spends half a minute jiggling them vigorously until the truck finally starts. I wonder aloud if all the detritus crammed in the SUV could be from a hobby. No, I don't have any time for any of that, Wood says. He adds that he's not terribly good with ordinary aspects of life, paying bills, say, or car washing. He's too consumed with inventing solutions to the world's problems. Ideas, really big ideas, keep bombarding his mind. It's like the rainforest, he says. Every afternoon, the rain comes. For most people, a comment like that would be preposterously self-important, if not delusional. But Wood is just telling the truth. At 74, he's been an inventor in residence at Intellectual Ventures, IV, a technology research and patent firm, for about a decade. He's paid to think and orchestrate international teams to develop products such as anti-concussion helmets, drug delivery systems, super-efficient nuclear reactors, anything really that might address some pressing need. In the 1980s, he led the development of the space lasers that were meant to shield the U.S. from the Soviet missiles as part of the Star Wars program. He's an astrophysicist, a self-trained paleontologist, and a computer scientist, and, as of a few months ago, the most prolific inventor in U.S. history. Thomas Alva Edison earned his last patent on May 16, 1933. U.S. patent number 1,908,830 is for a device that bonds two metals via electrolysis. It was hardly his most exciting invention. Going back to 1869, Edison had patented breakthroughs in communications, movies, lighting, and the power distribution. By the end of his career, he was an international celebrity with 1,084 utility patents to his name, the most for an American. That record stood until July 7, 2015, when Woods received U.S. patent number 9,075,906 for a device that can imbue medical gear with video conferencing and data transmission abilities so a patient can leave a hospital and use the machines at home. It's his 1,085th patent. Just as remarkable, Wood has more than 3,000 inventions awaiting perusal by the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office. He'll likely remain America's top idea man for many years to come. Wood's work at IV has included whimsical projects such as a laser-based shaver and a microwave that can customize its power for individual items on a plate. He's also worked on a low-power clothes dryer, anti-collision systems for cars, and a thermos for preserving vaccines. At least half of his activities, maybe more, are trying to help the least fortunate people on Earth, says Nathan Meyervold, IV's co-founder and former chief technology officer at Microsoft. He's really good at it. His ideas have already saved tons of lives and have the potential of saving enormously more. Wood insists that if he's smart, he didn't start out that way. Growing up in Southern California, he says, I didn't do well in any classes. He often failed or received the lowest score on the first exam given in a particular course and improved his marks through repetition and intense effort. The strategy worked. He skipped a couple of grades and enrolled at UCLA at 16, where he tested into the honors level calculus class. The worst score on the first exam, once again, was his. I'd gotten into the class on the basis of aptitude, not knowledge, which is a ruinous sort of thing, he says. It's like being told I understand the theory of swimming, and so here I am tossed into a high-speed river. The score horrified Wood, and he tried to make up for it with very hard extra credit problem. You had to figure out how to cover an area with tiles in a specified fashion, he says. This is back in 1958, and it was a famous math problem. It was hopeless, and everyone worked on it for a while and then threw it away. As it happened, UCLA had just taken delivery of the first digital computer west of the Mississippi. Wood taught himself how to use the machine over the Christmas break, and then wrote a program to solve the tiling problem. After he turned in his work, his professor accused him of cheating. And so I reached down in a briefcase and pulled out the program, he says. The professor's jaw literally dropped, and he said, "What is a computer? You can have the points if you teach me how to use this thing." Wood went on to get undergraduate degrees in chemistry and math from UCLA, as well as a doctorate in astrophysics. Then in 1972, he got a job at Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory, where he served as a protege of Edward Teller, the theoretical physicist and father of the hydrogen bomb. Wood worked on projects ranging from spacecraft to the use of gamma rays to place hidden watermarks on objects. Then came the Star Wars project, for which Wood pushed a team of scientists to build a weapon system capable of detecting and destroying Russian intercontinental ballistic missiles mid-flight. That Wood opens up about this is unexpected. Historians and journalists haven't been kind to Teller, one of the most polarizing figures of the Cold War, and Wood often gets lumped in with him as a fringe science lunatic, especially when it comes to Star Wars. After billions of dollars and years of controversy, the initiative never made it out of the lab. Wood is quick to suggest that he knew all along that the system, while technically feasible, was too complex and expensive to be practical. It was mainly for show, he says, a feint that broke the enemy's morale and treasury. I got the result that I wanted, he says. The Soviet Union collapsed. Check. It's done. The evil empire is no more. In 2006, after 4 decades in the government, Wood retired to become a full-time inventor. He met Myhrvold many years earlier, and the pair rekindled their friendship at a dinosaur conference. Myhrvold soon introduced Wood to Bill Gates. The men hit it off and now meet regularly to brainstorm. Lowell is the definition of a polymath, Gates says. It's not just how much he knows, it's the way his brain works. He gives himself the freedom to look at problems in a different way. To me, that is the mark of a great inventor. On a recent morning at Ivy, Wood putters past a disturbingly lifelike Tyrannosaurus Rex head hanging in the reception area toward a conference room. He's dressed, as usual, in slacks and a tie-dyed short-sleeve Oxford. The tie-dye, combined with his reddish-gray beard, suggests a hippie Santa. Listening to him is like binge-watching several seasons of Nova. He talks for 4 hours in a soft, deep voice, digressing into one intellectual rabbit hole after another. Physics, space lasers, pestilence, rockets, whale oil, lithography, fracking, Eidic memory, war. He's adept at the tangent. Did you know that measles is a zoonosis humans picked up from grazing animals 1,500 years ago? That somehow always relates back to the topic at hand. Wood attributes his ability to hop from subject to subject, making associations that sometimes lead to inventions, to reading, a lot. He subscribes to 3 dozen academic journals. I have a terrible deficiency of willpower once I open an electronic table of contents for physical review letters or the New England Journal of Medicine, he says. It's just terribly difficult to pull myself away from them. The more difficult the problem and the more layers of complexity it has, the more emphatic Wood's disquisitions get. Take his work on concussions. I didn't know the first thing about a concussion. I thought it was just a brain slamming against the interior of the skull, particularly violently, Wood looks down. It clearly bothers him that he had it wrong. Basically, that has nothing to do with what a real concussion is. A concussion occurs by the brain being very rapidly twisted inside the skull, and in particular, the so-called angular acceleration. It's not just the twist or the speed of the twist, but it is the time rate of change and the speed of the twist that tears neural fibers apart. It's a ghastly sort of thing. It literally just rips the nervous system apart. But the striking thing is that it piles up. If you do that same thing again a week or two later, or an hour or two later, heaven help you. The damage not only becomes more severe, but it takes much longer to heal. And if you do it three times in a bad afternoon on the soccer field or football field, the damage is likely to be permanent. An organization, he declines to say which, came to talk him into developing anti-concussion technology. He wasn't interested at first. NFL players are professional gladiators, he said. They know what they're doing. I mean, it's been documented for a decade or two that this is what happens to you. It's a self-inflicted wound. Why are we wasting our time? Well, it turns out that's not where most of the damage occurs. Most of the damage occurs on high school playing fields. Young males between the ages of 10 and 20 are the ones that are inadvertently, unknowingly, innocently taking damage. Wood's anti-concussion solution, much like football, isn't for the squeamish. Sensors in the helmet trigger a mechanism that fuses a player's helmet and shoulder pads. Wood is vague on exactly how that would work, but spikes or rods of some sort would shoot down from the helmet to keep the head from turning. In a fraction of a second, the helmet will put things down that will grab your collarbones, and not only will your neck not break, but your brain won't be damaged. That's what we've invented. Wood's refusal to say who approached him to work on helmet technology is typical cloak-and-dagger theater for IV. The company is an idea factory that often gets contracted to work on difficult, potentially lucrative problems. It keeps this work to itself until the invention has been patented and is ready to commercialize. Wood's anti-malaria technology is much closer to his background in weapons research. The photonic fence, which is to mosquitoes what Star Wars was meant to be to Soviet ICBMs. The system uses fence-mounted cameras and light sensors to measure insect size, speed, and wing flapping frequency. When a mosquito is detected, a laser zaps it into tiny puffs of smoke. On the subject of things like faster planes and engines, Woods becomes downright distraught and angry. What have we been doing, he asks. How can we be so lazy? He sees the world as a never-ending puzzle. It's an attitude that leaves others feeling optimistic after chatting with him. Famine, evil, impending environmental doom. They're but problems waiting to be solved. Wood, for example, is of the mind that global warming can be stopped relatively quickly and inexpensively through geoengineering. There's all kinds of solutions on the table that nobody denies are technical solutions. They're just not politically preferred solutions, he says. One such solution would be to sink the atmosphere's carbon dioxide into the deep ocean. Another would be to push the warm water on the top layer of the ocean down to the bottom. He seems most bullish on the idea of using high-altitude balloons to release particles of sulfur or some other substance that would, in effect, provide shade for the planet. He's convinced this wouldn't only be feasible, but would also come with few, if any, consequences. All these sorts of things involve capital investments on the order of $10 billion. But people are talking about going out and spending $1 trillion a year to cope with global warming. And they're not even doing a very good job of it, Wood says. The solutions are straightforward. He argues there's little chance of climate change or anything, really, natural or human-made, wiping out the species soon. He points out that the sheer number of humans makes us hard to kill, and says we're still not as good at mass destruction as we imagine. It's going to be a long, long time before the human race has the ability to threaten 90% of human lives. On a much brighter note, Wood thinks there are plenty of ideas, really big, great ones, left to be imagined. It's frankly illiterate to not be optimistic, Wood says. We're going to see a blossoming across essentially every front, unprecedented in human technological history. This is not something that's hoped for. This is baked in the cake. This was excerpted from an article that originally appeared in Bloomberg.com. On the health and science page, prescription drug use soars. Most Americans are now regularly taking prescription drugs, new research has found. Almost 60% of adults take some type of medication, and since 2000, the number of adults taking five or more prescription drugs has nearly doubled to 15%, raising serious concerns about the potential for adverse interactions. An aging U.S. population, expanded Medicare coverage, and aggressive TV marketing all play a role. But national surveys of nearly 40,000 people suggest the obesity epidemic is the primary culprit fueling this upward trend. 8 of the 10 most commonly prescribed drugs in the United States are used to treat high cholesterol, type 2 diabetes, and other preventable conditions associated with obesity. In fact, the most popular medication in the U.S. is Zocor, which is in a class of cholesterol-lowering drugs called statins. Overall use of statins jumped 10% over the past decade, while blood pressure medications increased by 7%. Here in the U.S., we aggressively peddle foods that propagate illness and drugs to treat the illness that ensues. Yale University nutritionist David Katz tells HealthyDay.com, "Big food and big pharma are the winners, we and our families the losers." Certain medications, however, are bucking the trend. Antibiotic use fell 1.5% over the past 10 years, and fewer women are undergoing hormone replacement therapy, which could reflect growing awareness about the risks and side effects associated with overuse of these drugs. Pediatricians versus anti-vaxxers. Amid recent outbreaks of vaccine-preventable diseases like whooping cough and measles, the medical community has grown increasingly exasperated with the growing anti-vaccination movement. Now many doctors are pushing back against parents who dig in their heels and refuse to immunize their children, the Chicago Tribune reports. A national survey shows that 1 out of 5 pediatricians routinely refuse to treat unvaccinated patients. In most cases, these doctors are in one of the 30 states with laws that don't allow people to avoid vaccination for philosophical reasons. Every month, 83% of doctors surveyed encounter at least one family that declines vaccinations, and 11% say the number of these so-called anti-vaxxers has increased over the past year. But the American Academy of Pediatrics and the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention discourage doctors from refusing unvaccinated patients, urging them to build relationships with skeptical parents, and attempt to convince them of the need for immunization. But in light of events such as the Disneyland measles outbreak that sickened almost 150 people last year, many providers do not want to expose their other patients to infectious diseases. You never want to cause a situation where a child loses care as a result of a family making a decision not to immunize, said pediatrician H. Deal Davies of the AAP. But for some doctors, it's a matter of the impact on the community at large. On the Talking Points page, we have Rubio. Are his finances a problem? Questions about Senator Marco Rubio's messy finances aren't going away, said Jeremy Peters in the New York Times. Bowing to pressure from Republican rivals and media critics, the Republican presidential hopeful last week released monthly statements from a Republican Party American Express credit card he used while a state legislator. The full records show Rubio charged $22,003 in personal expenses on the card from 2005 to 2008, ranging from movie tickets and meals to $3,756 to buy tiles for his home and $10,000 for a family reunion. Rubio attributes the charges to pulling out the wrong card and other errors, and his campaign said he'd reimbursed all personal charges to the party, though it did not provide proof. In hindsight, I would do it different to avoid all this confusion, Rubio said. I obviously don't come from a wealthy family. So where exactly is the scandal, asked Charles C.W. Cook in NationalReview.com. Did Rubio stick the GOP with a tab, or did he profit in any way? Not even close. Like millions of Americans, he simply used a company charge card for some personal expenses, then paid up. No brown envelopes, no secret transfers from the Caymans, no accusations of quid pro quo. There's nothing. Rubio has made mistakes, but he's also grappled with difficult financial decisions that Americans who are not as wealthy as Donald Trump have to make every day. But not all of us live beyond our means or charge home improvements to the company credit card, said Rhonda Swan in the Florida Sun-Sentinel. Despite an income in excess of $100,000 as a lawyer and politician, Rubio has constantly had money trouble, suggesting he lacks maturity and wisdom. He nearly foreclosed on a second home over late mortgage payments and liquidated $68,000 from an IRA, incurring a steep tax penalty. Is this the guy Americans want to hire to rein in spending and slash U.S. debt? Maybe voters will appreciate that Rubio can feel their financial pain, said Kimberly A. Strassel in the Wall Street Journal. But Americans like winners, and Rubio's financial struggles feed into concerns about his youth and inexperience. To make the doubts go away, Rubio has to display extraordinary competence in the campaign ahead to show he's come out of all of this smarter. The working class, dying of despair. Something truly disturbing is happening to middle-aged white Americans, said Jesse Singal in nymag.com. In a new study, two Princeton economists revealed last week that white Americans aged 45 to 54, particularly those with less than a college education, are dying at a startling rate. While other demographic groups in the U.S. and in other developed countries are enjoying longer and healthier lives, the mortality rate for white middle-aged Americans has risen 0.5% annually between 1999 and 2013, the equivalent of 500,000 additional deaths, or about 40 times the number of dead in West Africa's Ebola epidemic. What's killing these Americans is even more disturbing, said Olga Kazan in TheAtlantic.com. It's suicide, alcohol, and drug poisonings. As manufacturing and construction jobs have evaporated and wages have stagnated, blue-collar workers have turned to alcohol and opioids to numb their misery. To put it bluntly, middle-aged white Americans are dying of despair. Economics alone can't explain this grim phenomenon, said Ben Boychuk in the Los Angeles Daily News. There's been a profound shift in the culture over the past 15 years. Today, one out of nine Americans subsists on government disability payments provided by our bloated welfare state. Family life has disintegrated. The divorce rate among those over age 50 has doubled, while religion, once a source of community support, continues to wane. With their lives increasingly devoid of any meaning, it's no surprise a growing number of white Americans turn to booze, drugs, video games, porn, or whatever else dulls the pain. That may be partly true, said Ross Douthat in the New York Times. But don't forget that black and Hispanic Americans have their own problems with family structure and lag whites in wealth by far. Yet they aren't experiencing the same mortality crisis. Why? Minorities have had lower expectations and thus show more resilience in the face of poverty and disappointment. White working class Americans grew up believing they were the country's hardworking backbone and would have better lives than their parents. A widespread feeling of dispossession now haunts them. The result is an existential despair akin to that felt by Russians after the Soviet Union's collapse, said Paul Krugman, also in the Times. We're looking at people who were raised to believe in the American dream and are coping badly with its failure to come true. And a few short notes. Rural adolescents are committing suicide at roughly twice the rate of their urban peers, and suicide rates for all age groups grew by 20% in rural states from 2004 to 2013. The highest rates are in Wyoming, Alaska, and Montana, states where isolation is commonplace. Self-driving cars have logged more than 1 million miles, according to the research at the University of Michigan. During that time, they have been a total of 11 mostly minor crashes, and all of those were the fault of the drivers of other cars. And we'll finish with a quote from Groucho Marx. Outside of a dog, a book is your best friend. Inside of a dog, it's too dark to read. We've run out of time for today's episode of the week. Be sure to join us again next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Fred Woodward. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of the week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. The broadcast is available as a podcast right after the broadcast at our website, triangleReadingService.org. Questions or comments? Give us a call, 919-832-5138.